Well, open your Bibles with me to Genesis chapter 13. We have a bit of an ambitious journey today, making it through the entirety of this chapter. It'll go quickly, though. It really will. So as we have looked at the life of Abram, he has responded to God's call to travel from the land of Ur, the Chaldeans, to a future place that God would show him, reveal to him. And so this call from God to Abram includes the three main components of the book of Genesis within the patriarchs, as well as the entirety of the Pentateuch, and that is land, nation, and blessing. Continually remind yourself of this as we go through the book of Genesis. If you read ahead, or if you go back and review, remember land, nation, and blessing. These are woven into what God has called Abram for, what it is he will provide to Abram. So Abram has arrived in the land of promise. He's traveled over these 800 miles to get to this place. And when he gets there, God says, "This is the land that I'm going to give to you." He arrives first in Shechem and builds an altar there, and then travels a little bit further south to the region of Bethel Ai. And he also builds an altar there. As he has moved on from this region to the land of Egypt, he did so because of the famine in the land. And while in Egypt, he presented his wife Sarai as his sister, which is a partial truth. She was his half-sister, but she was also his wife. He did not relate to her as a sister. He related to her as a wife. So Abram is playing a very calculated game of risk without displaying any faith in the God that prompted him to move these 800 miles to this unknown land. And so this deceitful plan that Abram conjures up backfires on him. He's thinking that he's going to have time to go into Egypt to secure enough land to make it, enough food to make it through the famine. He's going to go back to the land, and while he's there, he's going to entertain this ruse of Sarai being available for marriage, potentially garnering him great favor with men. And so it backfires on him because Pharaoh doesn't negotiate. Pharaoh doesn't have a conversation. Pharaoh doesn't bring Abram to him to say, "What's it going to take? What will it require? Here's what I'm willing to offer." He simply abducts Sarai and takes her into the royal palace. And you would have to think that Abram is an absolute shock. This is not the plan. This is not the way he thought it was going to work out. So we aren't told of any of the conversation or negotiation. Pharaoh simply takes Sarai, and Abram is left wondering what went wrong. So Pharaoh gave Abram a large amount of livestock and servants in exchange for the abduction of Sarai. And so Abram is totally helpless to change the circumstance that he found himself in. He could not go knock on the door. He could not go demand her return. He could not threaten. He could not do anything but simply sit and wait and wonder what's going to happen, what will come of my beloved wife. Well, God would sovereignly intervene in this circumstance. He would protect the promises that he made to Abram, and he would rescue Sarai for him. Abram not being able to do anything, God can do everything. What is impossible for Abram is very possible for God, and this is exactly what takes place. God intervenes. He causes a plague to come upon the house of Pharaoh. The word plague there likely refers to some kind of a skin disease, perhaps something like leprosy, and apparently Sarai was unaffected by this, and it indicates that she's the cause. So this leads to Abram's deceitful plan being exposed, and then then Pharaoh sending them away. And so Abram leaves with his wife, and he keeps all the livestock that Pharaoh has given to him in exchange for Sarai. And so Abram's trip to Egypt is a fiasco. He did not display the same faith that caused him to journey from Ur to an unknown land. He simply goes into Egypt with this deceitful plan, thinking he can get some food, and everything falls apart. Abram was gripped with doubt and fear and self-reliance, and the outcome proved it. While he did leave Egypt with a valuable haul of livestock and servants, it came at an incredibly high cost. This isn't a lesson in God bailing us out. This is a lesson in the sovereign plan of God, the generosity of God, even when we are faithless, that He values the commitment that He's made to Abram above and beyond Abram's faithlessness. And so Abram leaves really with his tail tucked between his legs, wondering, how did I find myself here? So Abram is very much like us, a paradoxical mixture of self-centered reliance and faith in God. Think about that. We are a paradoxical mixture of self-centered reliance. I can do it. I don't need any help. I'll just wait for God when it's really, really desperate and I'm in an emergency. So we struggle with that paradox between being this duplicitous person and having this kind of faith in God. So this is what Abram is going to continually learn over the next several chapters. And so as we continue in chapter 13 and building on our outline, we come to number 7, and that is the return. So we're going to read through all of chapter 13, but we're going to divide this up into smaller sections. And so we're going to look at verse 1, which is a segue between the last section, the departure from Egypt, and the introduction to the narrative that we find ourselves in today. So verse 1 says, "So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev, he and his wife and all that belonged to him, and Lot with him." So it's a summarization of what had happened, and it is an introduction into what is about to happen as we go through this chapter. So as Abram left Egypt, he had many miles to think about what had just transpired. He had what was in his mind a great plan. Surely nothing could go wrong, right? I've thought about this. I put the pieces together. They're going to believe me. This is all going to work out really, really well. Well, it doesn't happen that way. So he was likely in Egypt for weeks, perhaps even months, with his wife in the royal palace, sitting helplessly by, wondering what's going to come of this. And so as he now leaves, after being reunited with Sarai, he heads back to the location where he previously was, where he worshipped the Lord and had pitched his tent in the area of Bethel Ai. And that leads us now into the building of the outline, 7a, blessings realized. Verses 2 through 4 is what we're going to look at first. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. He went on his journeys from the Negev as far as Bethel to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place of the altar which he had made there formerly, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. So verse 2 tells us that Abram was very rich in livestock, as well as being very rich in silver and gold. Now, we're not told in chapter 12 how Abram acquired this silver and gold, but the only possible outcome is that Pharaoh gave this to him in addition to the livestock and the servants. And so now, as a result of this deceitful plan, of this unraveling of a plan in Egypt, Abram departs a very, very wealthy man. The word rich in Hebrew is the word kabed, which means heavy. There is a contrast here that is lost in English because English translators have translated this word differently based upon how it is applied. It's the same word in two different places. So Abram went to Egypt because of the famine. And if you look back at chapter 12, verse 10, it tells us that the famine was severe in the land. That word severe in the Hebrew is the word kabed. It means heavy. Abram left for Egypt when the famine was heavy, and he returns to the Negev heavy with livestock and with gold and silver. It is a contrast between the faithlessness of Abram and going into Egypt with this deceitful plan, leaving the area that was heavy with famine, and God's generous sovereign plan being played out in his life, blessing him in spite of the faithlessness, and now he is entering back into the region from where he has come, heavy with livestock and with silver and with gold. His present success has come despite his failure in Egypt, which clearly highlights the overwhelming blessing and generosity of God, even when Abram exhibited zero faith. Now, we should not read this account and say, well, I guess my faithlessness doesn't have any negative consequences. No, that's not true at all. Abram's wife Sarai was in the royal palace for an undetermined amount of time, not knowing exactly what transpired there. And I would have to think that Abram would be willing to trade all of this to undo the circumstance that he placed his wife in. Now, you would think that, and that is probably the lesson that Abram should get. But we're going to read in just a few more chapters that Abram repeats this, having not learned his lesson. So, God's sovereign plan and promise includes the personal blessing to Abram, land, nation, blessing. Here we see this first overwhelming sign of blessing, all this livestock, the servants, the gold and the silver. So, Abram leaves Egypt completely failing God by expressing zero faith, and yet God still blesses Abram with these material goods. God is faithful to his plan. God is faithful to his promises. Our faithlessness probably limits what God is willing and able to do, but it doesn't negate what God has committed to doing. So if this is God's blessing, in the face of Abram's faithlessness, how much more will the blessings of God be realized when faith and obedience are present? Now, if God blesses Abram overwhelmingly with the livestock and the servants and the gold and silver in his faithlessness, how much greater will the blessing be when faith and obedience are matched to the call of God? Well, this is a lesson that Abram is going to learn. This is a lesson that you and I need to continually learn. So I would anticipate the paradox is not lost on Abram, even though we will see him repeat this failure in the very near future. So Abram returns to the area where he had previously pitched his tent, the region of Bethel Ai, the place where he built the altar first, and then, secondly, and then called on the name of the Lord. So this was a place Abram probably identified as whole, since he has pitched his tent here, and because it was here that he had called upon the name of the Lord, and when he did that, he was symbolically claiming the land promised to him. So when Abram called on the name of the Lord, he was likely thanking God for the land that he has given to him, and for his faithfulness in fulfilling the blessing promised so many years earlier when he called him out of Ur of the Chaldeans. So we are told that Abram again worships God upon arriving back at Bethel Ai, upon reflecting on his failure and looking out over the vast blessing that God has dropped into his lap. Abram is moved to worship God. In our moments of failure, we must worship. In our moments of success and prosperity, we must worship. And this is exactly what Abram does. Letter B in our outline, we see Abram's generosity. Verses 5 through 8. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, and the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for the possessions were so great that they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. Now the Canaanite and the Perizzite were dwelling then in the land. So Abram's vast wealth has created a problem. The area cannot sustain all of the animals that are now possessed. So Lot here becomes a focused figure. This is the first of three Abram-Lot stories that we're going to see in the early part of the patriarchal study. So here, Lot and Abram will separate, and then we're going to see in chapter 14 that Abram will rescue Lot, who is captured during the Battle of the Kings. And then further on, in chapters 18 and 19, Abram will rescue Lot from Sodom and Gomorrah. So all throughout this narrative, Moses is keeping Lot in the storyline, and here he is a bit of a central figure in the storyline. In each of these three stories, Lot is portrayed as a contrast to Abram and reflects character traits of greed and foolishness. Each time Lot is centralized in the narrative, it is a contrast to the life and the character of Abram, and it exhibits this contrast through greed and foolishness, and we'll explore this more when we get there. Now, we aren't told anything about Lot in chapter 12. He appears in chapter 13, verse 1, as returning with Abram from Egypt. So clearly, he traveled from this region of Bethel-Ai down into Egypt because of the famine, and now he is journeying back with Abram. Here in verse 5, it tells us that Lot also has flocks and herds and tents, but we aren't told how Lot acquired these or when these came into his possession. So it almost certainly points to the reality that Abram has gifted these things to Lot because he would have no other way to acquire them on his own. So the mentioning of Lot's tents also indicates that he has servants, likely also given to him by Abram. Now verse 6 tells us that the accumulated livestock is too large for the area, and verse 7 tells us of the friction that now exists between the herdsmen of Abram and Lot. There's no real way to pinpoint the amount of time that has transpired from the journey from Egypt to this point. There could have been some reproduction taking place within the livestock. And if you think that is what is taking place, it nearly doubles in the time that they've left Egypt to the time that there's now not enough land to feed all of the animals that are there. So there's a conflict brewing. And so rather than seeking unity and finding a way to work together through this tremendous blessing that God has given them, this blessing now divides them. So added to the problem in this overwhelming number of livestock is the reality that the Canaanite and the Perizzite are also in the land and have livestock that need to graze as well. So this is kind of a modern Moses in the wilderness period talking about the Canaanite and the Perizzite in this time. He's bringing this to the forefront in the minds of the hearers during the wilderness wanderings about the reality that Abram and Lot found themselves in as they moved back into this region with all of this livestock. So Abram has generously blessed Lot as the Lord has blessed him. And here we see the epitome of blessing in allowing Lot first choice of grazing land as they resolve to solve the dispute between the herdsmen of Abram and of Lot's livestock. So we're going to look at Abram's generosity continuing in verses 8 and 9. So Abram said to Lot, Abram initiates the conversation. He says, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the left, then I will go to the right, or if to the right, then I will go to the left. So here we see an interesting twist in the relationship between Abram and Lot. Abram refers to Lot like a brother, even though Lot is in fact just a nephew. So Abram appeals to this brotherly relationship as a way of resolving this dispute peacefully. So Abram says, please, and in the Hebrew that word means, I pray you. And so twice Abram prayerfully appeals to their kinship to find a peaceful way of resolving this problem. This speaks to both the generous and noble character of Abram and the way he desires to resolve this friction in the relationship. So what is also highlighted here is the faith that Abram displays by allowing Lot first choice of the grazing land. Lot, you can go wherever you want to go. I will go the opposite direction. So what this means is that Abram would accept whatever Lot rejected. Think about that. Abram is going to accept whatever Lot rejected. And Abram believed the land was his to distribute. fully believing in the promise God made to him in giving this land. I think it's a very interesting insight that Abram didn't see any conflict with the people that were already inhabiting the region. He says, this is my land to give. You go where you want to go. I'll go the opposite direction. An incredible amount of faith that Abram is expressing here in allowing Lot to go to the area that he desires. So the note here in verse 7 that the Canaanite and the Perizzite were in the land highlights not only the lack of grazing land, but the reality is that Abram already considers this land to be his own. Even though the Perizzite and even though the Canaanite live here, Abram says, this is mine to give out. You go where you want. It's yours. So letter C in our outline, Abram and Lot separate. We'll look at verses 10 through 13 here. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Now there's a lot of foreshadowing. There's a lot of introduction into what is going to be experienced in the very near future. But Lot looks out over the land, and the choice to him is obvious. The lush, well-watered valley of the Jordan. The description that Moses gives to the readers here is that this was like the garden of the Lord, hinting back to what it was like in the Garden of Eden, where everything grew easily, where there was just plenty of everything. And apparently this land in Zoar on your way to Egypt, which is also a lush, fertile land, this is the kind of land that Lot can see as he looks out over the land. And what is highlighted here are a few things. One is the greediness of Lot is being focused here. He didn't defer the choice to the elder Abraham. You are my uncle. You are my elder. You are the one to whom this call has come. No, don't let me choose. You choose. Nowhere in Lot's thinking does that even occur to him, that that would be proper. He only saw how his choice would benefit him. Additionally, Lot's livestock was gifted to him by Abram, and yet he selfishly only thought of that which would benefit him the most. Thirdly, by choosing the most fertile area, he displayed no concern over how this may negatively affect Abram, the one who had so generously blessed him. You can see, as a contrast to Abram's generous and noble character, a lack of generosity, a lack of nobility in the character of Lot himself. All of Lot's decisions here are based on what he sees and on what he wants, and not on what is right. Never enters into Lot's mind. As we'll see in chapter 14, the decision that Lot makes is the worst one that he could make, because what Moses tells us here, as a bit of a parenthetical statement, is that Lot settled in the cities of the valley, and by doing so, he immersed himself in the wickedness and the sinfulness of the people groups there. It was very likely directly impacted by what he saw in the culture that he had now joined himself to. Moses inserts this parenthetical reference here about Sodom and Gomorrah, that this was before the Lord destroyed them, and the wickedness there is described as being exceedingly great before the Lord. So, again, a foreshadowing of the destruction that is going to come to Sodom and Gomorrah. It likely was a somewhat lush and fertile area, which is why Lot wanted to go that direction. So this introduces us to the future Abram-Lot story that's going to come out in chapter 14, as well as displaying the carelessness of Lot's choice in moving so close to the wicked cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Did Lot not know? Was Lot not aware? Well, the reality is Lot didn't even care. It wasn't a consideration at all. He only saw what benefited him, what appeared and appealed to his eyes, with no regard for how it might potentially impact him. So Lot moved to the eastern boundary of Canaan, near the cities. And if you remember, in the book of Genesis, almost every time someone moves east, it means they are moving away from the Lord. This is exactly what Lot is doing. So Abram settles in the land of Canaan. Lot moves to the eastern edge among the cities. After they have separated, we get the letter D here, and that is God speaks. We'll look at verses 14 through 17. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you." So again, God reaffirms his promises to Abram. And so God speaks to Abram, but we aren't told how. A vision, a dream, an appearance while he was praying at the altar. We don't have any idea. It doesn't really matter. It is very, very clear that God speaks and Abram listens and believes in what God is telling him. Two of the three components of God's promises are restated here. That is land and nation. Abram is already experiencing incredible blessing as he looks out over the livestock, as he looks out over the land, as he lugs around this gold and this silver. The blessing is already beginning to be realized. The land and nation are what are now being reiterated as Abram looks out and thinks about his descendants being as numerous as the dust of the earth. So God invites Abram to lift up your eyes. The invitation is to look north and south and east and west as far as your eye can see. I am giving you this land to you and to your descendants forever. So not only is Abram to look, he is invited to walk the land, to take in its beauty, to gaze upon its features, because God is going to give it all to Abram and to his descendants. So in ancient practice, walking the land was a symbolic act of legally acquiring the land and staking a claim to it. If you think about it, back when the West in America was settled, they would ride out on horseback and they would race to a claim and they would stake a claim in the ground, they would walk it, and they were claiming this as their own possession. Where did that come from? Ancient practice. And so this is exactly what God is inviting Abram to do. Walk the land, look upon it, claim it as your own, because it is in fact my gift to you. Twice God says, "I will give." The world belongs to him. It is his to give as he desires. And here, God repeats that he is gifting this land to Abram and his descendants forever. Speaking of the descendants, they will be as numerous as the dust of the earth, which indicates that Abram's descendants will be incalculable. You just can't count them. They're too numerous. There's no way you can ever put a number into how many descendants came from Abram. In fact, I tried to investigate that, and there's just no way to do it. Abram not only had his wife Sarai, but also had Hagar and gave birth to Ishmael, but he had other wives and had other children. And you'd have to think that a humongous portion of the world's population could be directly connected back to Abram. Physical descendants, not necessarily spiritual descendants. And so Abram's descendants are literally more numerous than the dust of the earth. But this promise represents more than just the physical ancestry. but also a spiritual one. Why? Because if you go all the way back to Genesis 3:15, the promise of the seed that would come from the woman who had crushed the head of the serpent, that individual would flow through the line of Abram. That individual will become the Messiah of Israel, the Savior of the world, Jesus Christ Himself, and He is a direct descendant of Abram, and the descendants of Jesus Christ are more numerous than the dust of the earth. Thinking about how many billions of Christians have existed from the beginning, including those of the Jewish faith who possessed faith in God apart from what was not yet seen, a significant portion of the world's population is very likely a part of this spiritual ancestry that is attributed back to Father Abraham. Now, lastly in our outline, letter E, Abram worships. Verse 18, then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. So this becomes a constant theme for Abram. There is a constant building of altars, staking claim in an area, and worshiping the Lord. In very quick succession, we're told that he entered, he pitched his tent, he built an altar, he settled in this area. So Hebron is located in the south central mountains of Judah. I didn't put him a map up. The highest city in Palestine, about 19 to 20 miles south-southwest of Jerusalem. And this region, the region of Hebron, becomes a primary settlement for Abram and also for Isaac. There's significant burials that will take place in this region. Abram wants to go back. Isaac wants to go back, and it is in this region that they are eventually buried. So as we summarize what we've looked at so far, there is a stark contrast displayed here between Abram and Lot. Lot lifted up his eyes and parted for his possessions. Abram lifted up his eyes and stayed for God's promises. Lot chose the things that are seen and eventually found them to be very corrupting to his life. Abram looked and saw through the eyes of faith the things that are unseen, and he found great assurance and peace in the sovereign rule of God. So while in Egypt, Abram displayed little faith, but while in the land of promise, Abram was a stalwart, believing in the literal promises of God. This is what these patriarchal narratives are all about. It is about the promise of land and nation and blessing, how this was birthed through the patriarch of Abram, how it is continued through Isaac and Jacob and many, many others. And what we need to be remembering here as the people of God is that as His children, we are the recipients of incredible promise and of incredible blessing because of a sovereign God who generously blesses in spite of our faithlessness, in spite of our wandering. God is always there. God is always faithful. God is always willing to give to us far more than we deserve, far more than we think. And I believe this is out of the prayer that Paul prayed to Him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we ask or think according to the power that dwells within us. To Him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus through all generations, forever and ever. Amen.